Hello and welcome to the CISS podcast. This is the Point series by China Forum. In this series, we will have one-on-one discussions with top-level officials, diplomats, well-known entrepreneurs, academics, and media experts from both China and abroad to hear their fresh insights on important global issues.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Point series. This is Beibei from China Forum, Tsinghua University. Nothing has held more attention in the media than the tariff policies coming from Trump 2.0. Through all ups and downs in numbers and back and forth in negotiations, what are the tariffs really about? Has China been preparing itself for such trade shocks? What impact will these tariffs have on industries such as electric vehicles, AI, or clean tech? We need real experts to help us see through all the smoke and get a clear picture of the underlying currents. Today we have invited Professor John Gong from the University of International Business and Economics, who is also a China Forum expert, to help us answer these questions. Very warm welcome, Professor Gong.
Thank you very much. It's always a great pleasure to be here.
It's very nice to be able to interview you face-to-face again. So let's start with the big picture. In your recent writings, you argued that this new round of tariffs is not just about trade deficits or protecting U.S. manufacturing. Rather, it reflects a structural attempt by the Trump administration to reshape the foundations of U.S.-China economic relations. How should we interpret the strategic intent behind this trade offensive? Is it about economic protectionism or something more geopolitical and long-term?
Well, I think it even goes well beyond just geopolitical considerations. I think what the Trump administration is doing is in line with its reshaping of America's foreign policy. You know, President Trump has held this view for a long time that the entire, what we call rules-based international order, you know, with the WTO at its core, as something that is fundamentally at odds against American national interests. He has been always saying this for a long time. He thinks that, you know, the entire system, the global governance system, is against American interests. America cannot compete in that system. And, you know, many, many more countries have been essentially taking advantage of the United States. He interprets trade deficits by America as other countries ripping off the United States, as stealing money from the United States. So I think what he is intending, well, by the way, I also want to say that, you know, he has this feeling for a long time, this thinking for a long time, and more recently reinforced by sort of a more theoretical foundation by his former USTR, United States Trade Representative, Robert Lighthizer. You know, Lighthizer has a whole series of theories about, entire theory about how this system has been working against the United States, and more recently by his economic advisor, Stephen Miron, who also has a set of theories about how what he called this Triffin dilemma has been hurting the United States. So, you know, all of these things essentially are building a story for him that the entire system, the entire global system has to be dismantled, has to be upended, has to be eviscerated. And certainly, you know, China being the largest trading nation in the world is part of that struggle. It's a major piece of that struggle. That is why, you know, he is essentially waging an entire trade war against the entire world, right? Imposing tariffs on, you know, about 100 countries so far. So, you know, this is his major reason why he's doing this. And of course, this is also sort of convoluted with other factors and considerations strongly being held by other team members of his administration. You know, there's the theory you've just mentioned, you know, the trade deficit with China in particular, which is very large. And also, you know, the consideration that manufacturing is very important. It has a very deep value chain. It creates more jobs. It's a spillover effect. And more importantly, it's the foundation of America's defense industry supremacy around the world, right? So, you know, these are also considerations. And I also want to mention another theory that tariff revenues have to be another source of federal budget, right? And this is sort of more of a tactical solution, essentially, to raise taxes to compensate for the income tax reform. He called it reform. Essentially, it's actually giving a break to the rich people, tax reductions for rich people. But America is in serious financial trouble right now. And we can talk about this later. I mean, it's really a serious financial trouble from a fiscal point of view. And he's relying upon the tariff revenues to be a major source to compensate for that tax loss on the income tax side. And he actually, you know, is indeed able to show that he has indeed raised what he called hundreds of billions of dollars of tax revenues from tariff as a result of the first trade war with China. And now, you know, several months into the second trade war, he's already collected a lot of tariff revenues. So he can say, yes, this is a viable revenue source. So there are several theories behind this. Mm-hmm. A convoluted sort of a set of motivations to do this.
Speaking of Plan B, I think even though China didn't start this tariff war, but China does have Plan B and probably Plan C and Plan D. So you actually argue that China began preparing for scenarios like this as early as 2018 through the dual circulation strategy, state-led innovation drives, and deeper outbound investment. How effective have these measures been so far for China in buffering against this latest trade shock? And are there particular vulnerabilities that still remain exposed in this round of escalation?
I think it's absolutely true that the Chinese government and the corporate world have been planning for this for some time. They know that if Trump comes to power, this is something coming. And they also have a very high assessment of the probability that Trump will come back. And indeed, he did come back. So I think it is no doubt that you know, we've been preparing for this in terms of a couple of things, in terms of trying to beef up consumption, you know, turning this economy into more of a domestic consumption-oriented economy, as any great power, great economy, large-size economy will have to do. You know, this is epitomized by President Xi's proposal of this idea of dual circulation, right? It's all about that. And Chinese companies have been thinking about this, you know, going overseas, move some of their operations overseas. And also, I think today, basically, China is writing off America as a not even reliable, a viable supply of key technologies. It's dispensing with this whole idea that China and the United States can still cooperate in technological areas. So it's pretty much adopting a indigenous technologies for practically everything.
But it's not because China wanted to.
It's in response. Of course, it's a reactive, it's a protective set of measures. You know, we would like to live in a world where we have this, you know, very lovely idea of global value chain. There's, you know, partners cooperating in this ecosystem. There's going to be division of labor and capital around the world, you know, optimizing global resources. I mean, it's a very beautiful narrative. No longer can afford to believe in this anymore, because after rounds and rounds of choking, essentially, right, sanctions by the Trump administration, by the previous Biden administration, we have to come to the conclusion that this thing is never going to end. It just keep mounting. But I do want to say one thing. That is one thing that the corporate world and the Chinese government probably have miscalculated, have never thought about, is that the idea of Washington even targeting Chinese operations overseas, it is starting to have sort of a selective policy against, say, you know, Chinese companies in Mexico in specific, in Vietnam in specific. This is something probably, you know, the Chinese side have never thought about. It has come down to this level of sophistication and severity.
I see. Speaking of solar technology, it's not just targeting this particular industry. So the tariffs target China's strengths in sectors like electric vehicles, batteries, and solar technology. And some analysts see this as a deliberate effort to block China from consolidating its position in the future global supply chain. So how far has this decoupling effort gone in practical terms? And which industries are already seeing significant relocation or fragmentation?
Well, there's a broader context behind this. That is the Sino-US, what's called grand competition. And this grand competition is mostly about the technological competition, essentially, right? I mean, this is the front and center piece of that competition. So from America's national interest perspective, it has an incentive to essentially, if not stopping, but at least rolling back or limiting or restraining the market footprint of Chinese products and Chinese companies. And I think this is being done not just so much for restricting China's exports to the United States. It has come to the stage of American foreign policy essentially forcing, coercing other countries from adopting Chinese products. And these products are not just sort of what I consider strategic products, like, you know, 5G products from Huawei. America used to do this. And that probably can understand that, okay, you know, telecom is very different. It consists national interest. It consists national security. Mm-hmm. It's the core of the country's communication infrastructure, which is very critical, right? This you can understand. But now they're actually doing things for products that are not of this kind of nature anymore. Let me give you some examples. U.S. Department of Commerce, BIS, that's the organization responsible for export control. It's going around the world telling other countries not to use Huawei handsets equipped with Harmony operating system. This has nothing to do with national security, right? And not just Huawei products, but other products loaded with Harmony operating system. You know, this is not about export control or import control. This is about coercing other countries export and import control. This has nothing to do with the United States. So I think, you know, when it comes to China-US competition, I think as long as this competition is healthy, it's fair and justified, I think it's okay. It probably it's going to be good for both countries, you know, if it's kind of a fair competition. But when you go around the world telling other countries, other markets not to use Chinese products, this is not fair competition.
And does
right?
it even have an alternative if you don't import something?
Exactly.
China?
I mean, this is actually forcing other countries to
pay more,
choose worse of products, and you know, impose essentially a cost on other countries, forcefully in some many cases, using its sphere of influence, using its capabilities to influence other countries' politics. So, you know, this is not just, I don't think this is fair competition. It's not even competition, right? It's not competition.
Speaking of red communist China and all the obstacles to bringing back manufacturing to the U.S., the list seems to be endless. And a little bit more on EVs and AI and clean tech. So U.S. is betting on massive subsidies through the Inflation Reduction Act and the CHIPS Act, while China continues to rely on state coordination and industrial planning. In your view, which model is more sustainable over the long term? And who is better positioned to win the race for leadership in emerging industries like EV, clean technology?
Well, I think what's happening here is that there's been a lot of soul searching about this competition between the United States and China. And they look at what China has been doing in industry after industry after industry. And they've come to realize that, you know, you have this Chinese model that's been producing these success stories, been very successful in dominating, you know, one industry after another. And essentially, Washington decides to copy it. They want to do the same thing as China has been doing. That it's all about industrial policy. You know, industrial policy is essentially about state aid, subsidies, and all of these things. So the CHIP Act and the Inflation Reduction Act, these are probably the world's largest subsidy acts ever seen. I mean, it's billions and billions of hundreds of billions of dollars poured into this. Now, what I would tell my American friends is that, you know, you're trying to learn from China, right? I mean, let's just be very honest and admit it. You try to learn from China, but you're actually learning the wrong thing. I think what's really happening here in China, it's not just about sort of industrial policy and subsidies. I mean, some of the subsidies actually coming from the local government. Most of the subsidies actually coming from the local governments. It's really the intense competition in the market that is, when you think about it, what the subsidies have been doing. Subsidies essentially make the business case more viable. So essentially lowers the bar for market entry. It just incentivizes more entrants, basically, right? More companies, more projects located in different local governments, jurisdictions, they compete in the market. The end result is a over-intensified market competition, in my view, is intense competition. But the good thing about this is that there's a spillover effect. I mean, the intense competition eventually will lead to some kind of a market consolidation. And the surviving companies are very, very competitive. They're fiercely competitive. They're fiercely competitive globally, actually. I mean, you know, one of the clear implications of an intensified competition domestic market is that everyone starts to export, right? They try to seek markets overseas. So, you know, the surviving companies are not just intensely and fiercely competitive. They're also fiercely competitive internationally, globally. So this is the whole Chinese lesson, I would say. The American market doesn't have any of these things. You don't have intense competition. I mean, let's take solar as an example. I mean, it provides a lot of money, subsidies to these solar companies. And how many solar companies in the United States, are big solar companies in the United States right now? It's only one for solar, right? So there's no competition, essentially. So I think Washington is learning the half-cooked, half-baked.
The shell of it.
The half-baked lesson from China. They have one piece and they don't have the other piece.
Let's move on to another question about President Trump, who is often described as a deal maker in chief, who applies business style logic in foreign policy, even using maximum pressure, followed by the possibility of transactional bargains. Do you see this round of tariffs as reflecting that kind of business mindset?
Yes, absolutely. This is exactly what he's doing. But I think China's response is very unique in that it doesn't succumb to this kind of intimidation at all. China is indeed negotiating from a position of strength. And this is indeed the way to deal with Mr. Trump, I'm afraid, because he despises weakness. If you succumb to him, what you get in return is nothing but contempt. So I think what China has been doing is absolutely right. And it sets the example. And in some way, I think the European Union and Japan are doing exactly that. I think inspired what China has come out of this negotiation, they've been taking relatively strong positions vis-a-vis Washington. So I think this is the right response.
So to push it a little further, does this open a window for China to pursue a great bargain with the U.S. on critical economic or security issues?
Well, there's some reports about a grand bargain, what they call a grand bargain, that is currently being negotiated underway. I'm not sure about that. I haven't read anything reported. We have to wait and see. But I'm all for this. I think a grand bargain to essentially delineate the boundaries of the things that America and China both care about is actually a good thing. And if it succeeds, all the best.
Mm. And finally, last question for today. If we are really entering an era of parallel systems, one centered on the U.S., the other on China, then the implications go beyond bilateral trade. How should we understand the broader impact of this split on global trade governance, multilateral institutions, and third countries? And can any actor, such as Europe, ASEAN, or others, serve as a bridge or a stabilizer in this geopolitical and economic divide?
I think we are heading towards that direction of a parallel system. It's not going to be an entirely exclusively parallel system. I mean, there are some overlappings, I would say. But more or less, I think it's fair to say that we're going to see essentially a trading network, more of a China-centric trading network, and a separate, more of a Washington-centric trading network. And the implication of this is that I think the current set of entire global trade governance, multilateral institutions, they are in limbo. And I think at least China and the European Union and other major trading countries, nations, powers, have an incentive to still sort of defend and maintain this system, even though it's going to be in limbo. But I think a total return to a pre-World War system, a ruler system, is not in China's interest. This is essentially a jungle out there. But I think, sort of a partial effective system with some degree of American participation, as well as American sabotage, is the new normal we're going to face in the years to come. And I think the issue is how to deal with this kind of a very complicated and also very difficult situation, and to the extent possible, still try to maintain a rules-based order. And that's what China can essentially do. And not much beyond that, I would say. The United States is still very much a powerful country, holds a huge percentage of global GDP. If Washington decides to withdraw from something, Washington decides to sabotage or roll back something, it's very difficult to stop, in my view. So, we have to essentially struggle with this sort of not very effective system for many years to come.
I see. Thank you. Thank you, Professor Guang, for your deep insights.
Thank you.
And that will really help us to see through this one. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.